Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
So, hey, kids, and welcome to Grumpy Nostalgia, the Second Look Cinema podcast, the show where we go back to that blockbuster new release wall in our memory, grab a copy off the shelf, pop it in the old VCR, and see what time has done to it, but probably more accurately, what time has done to us. I'm Justin. That's Mike.
Cheers.
And we're here to help you navigate all those landmines glittered down memory lane. So, Mike, we're back.
Yes, it's us again. And this is a movie that's really more in your bailiwick, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately. I've since the little boy from 1977, I've been in a state of suspended adolescence ever since. So no complaints. But yeah, this movie has kind of taken over my life. But we'll get to that in a second. So, you know, it seems like, just a few hours ago, we were back in these grumpy Lou studios recording the last show, Mike. And it's interesting. I think you were so inspired by the last, some of the scenery in the last movie. You took it upon yourself to travel around the country and see some of that was so prominently showcased in the last movie, right, Mike?
You're right. I wanted to go to the Timberline Lodge there in Oregon, which was where I ended up going, the Seattle and Oregon area. But instead of going left towards the mountains, I went right towards the coast. And, found some cool spots around Astoria where, hey, they filmed The Goonies, Free Willy, Kindergarten Cop, what else, Point Break, and Twilight. There was multiple places where we went to film Twilight.
All right. Now I'm interested, yeah. Hey, is it true that the Goonies never say die, Mike? Is that still the case?
Yes. That's what Sean Astin told me.
Yeah, so well, you know, while you were out, you know, gallivanting across the country enjoying yourself, I was left home writing the script and researching all this data for this gloriously dumb movie. But we're glad to have you back in the Carolinas, Mike. We're very excited.
Glad to be
so
on.
Yeah, so speaking of excited, you know, a lot of people of my like are very excited because we've got a lot of anticipation about the new Kenobi series coming out next week, starring
Disney Plus,
Ewan McGregor.
Yes.
Disney Plus. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I get my streaming services confused.
Oh, you're fine. I think he makes a good young Alec Guinness.
Yes. But interesting. I think Alec Guinness was roughly a few years older than Ewan McGregor when he filmed the original Star Wars than he is now. And the age difference is quite, let's just say Ewan looks a little bit better at that age.
Yeah. I think
it's the same thing about Ewan.
Yeah. I think he never looks
bad.
Oh, yeah. I think we should tell, you know, like, I know you've mentioned him a couple of times on these podcasts. He's doing his motorcycling trips around the world and whatnot. And he does that show.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah. That's the Long Way Up. He's currently featured on the Apple Plus. Yeah. So interesting. So, you know, he always looks good. It's kind of annoying because he's roughly our age, Mike, and I've never seen him look bad, except for his odd hair choice in this movie.
The little ponytail.
Yeah, he looks terrible. he looked better in Trainspotting, coming out of that toilet.
Coming out of a toilet, yes. But I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, but for some reason, they couldn't manage to make the young Obi-Wan look cool. As I mentioned, you know, we're very excited about this show, and just about every Star Wars fan is over the moon ready for this thing to start. So we thought it would be a perfect opportunity to go back to where that story kind of all began. And of course, Mike, we're going to be looking at Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace. So it doesn't seem like it's that far away to be considered nostalgia, Mike, but this was in the last century.
I know, right? Over 99. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, so how's that feel? Yeah, so it's kind of the youngest movie we've done on this format before, but when you sit down and look at the brass tacks, it's kind of an old movie, Mike. To a Gen Z or a millennial, this is an old movie. So there's all kinds of stuff to talk about on this. There's all kinds of ways to do some analysis and kind of talk about it, but in the context of what it was. But we'll just kind of go through and just kind of let the audience decide what our take is on it after all these years. And, you know, I've been a Star Wars apologist for years, Mike, so I may be a little skewed on this one.
Yeah, I think our listeners should know your, I'm going to say, your great field of knowledge of this subject of Star Wars from how many different forms of media do you have the original trilogy on? What'd you
get?
Yeah,
all of them.
You got, I know you got the laser.
including Japanese laser discs. Oh, yeah.
And now you
I think I was most proud of the first time I was the first person to actually find and score the widescreen VHS copies that before that was even the letterbox formats were even there. Back when you could go to the mall, we'll explain what the mall is to our younger listeners later. But you could go, they just had media plays and, you know, stores that would sell media content, hard media. You know, you could buy physical copies of things. And I found a small video store in Orland Park, suburban Chicago, Illinois, that sold a collector's edition letterbox screen edition of all three movies. And that was a prized possession for years.
Oh my God.
Because nobody had seen those, you know, since, except for being in the original theaters. So, yeah, but I've had them all.
That's good. And you got maybe a few hours logged on, was it Battlefront? Is that a
Star Wars game? Shamelessly, thousands of hours playing Star Wars video games. And, I'm not particularly proud of any of these accomplishments.
I want to make sure our listeners know you're not a new kid to the rodeo on this subject.
No, not exactly. It's as I mentioned,
I've seen Empire Strikes Back once. I've seen Return of the Jedi once. I've seen these prequels we just witnessed, first one. I saw it once in the theater, and I think part of it once later on. But that's the good part about this whole nostalgia thing is we can kind of, at least for me, you know, I have a. Now I'm literally looking at this movie 20 years later and, you know, trying to grasp what I'm looking at. Because I hear people talk about, you know, Trade Federation, Republic, Empire. I'm like, who's who? So I'm still at that novice level, let's just say.
Well, let's just call you the yin to my yang. So it's probably good that you're here because I'm probably a little too deep in it. So it might be a good thing to flesh out through this conversation. So you can pull me back to Earth. So this was released on. Yes. Sorry, go ahead. Mm.
I couldn't remember if you were one of the people who saw this the first night. Did you see this as a midnight showing?
No, actually, we'll get into that.
Okay.
It's an interesting. My first viewing is an interesting story. So this was the most anticipated movie of all time, Mike, at the time. So, and great. I think it will always hold that title. It'll always hold that title for a couple of reasons. One, because it was just huge. And I think the second reason is, I don't think anything's ever going to come close to this again, because the conditions don't exist that would predicate.
Incredible. You know, you think about people who went to movies. You think about people who went to movies just to watch the trailer, you know?
I got some notes about that. So it's this was before there was they called it the World Wide Web back then, Mike. But it was not quite, you know, you couldn't, you know, download
dial-up
trailers very easy. Yeah. So I remember I was the local hero at work one day because I figured out I think the trailer was released on Apple QuickTime. Everybody remembers that.
Oh my gosh.
And November 17th, 1998. And at the time it set a record for 10 million downloads, Mike. That was the big thing.
So a year before it came
but
out.
I remember.
Wow.
Yeah. About 6 months before. Yeah.
Oh, so, okay.
And it was cool because I remember literally stealing about 300 feet of Ethernet cable and connecting, my little work computer to the local server at my work and downloading this little postage stamp size trailer, QuickTime trailer. I think it took about 6 hours to download the 1 minute, 53 second trailer. But you know, even people that did not like me at work were coming in my office and making casual conversations because they heard that, and by the way, I heard that you downloaded the Star Wars trailer. Can I take a look? But that was the kind of thing. I mean, and then, you know, you talked about the release in the attached to the certain movies trailers. So like I think the movies The Siege, Meet Joe Black, and The Waterboy. If you don't remember, the Waterboy is that Adam Sandler where he talks in the funny voice. That one. all those movies had market analysts suggested that they probably had about a 30% increase in ticket volumes because all that could be attributed to people coming in, buying full price for a ticket watching the Phantom Menace trailer and then just hightailing it out of there. But yeah, with the merchandising and, you know, every local newscast had, you know, they sent their local, reporter to the, whatever the local cinema was. And they interviewed all the idiots out there in their cosplay at the time. And they're on their lawn chairs talking about how excited they were. So it was just exciting. And that thing just kind of, it built for months and months and months. But yeah, and it was a big thing for sure. Very, very anticipated, but conditions don't exist like that anymore. And I doubt very highly that, you know, by the time movies of that scale come out now, people have seen the first 7 minutes on YouTube. They've seen featurettes. They've read about it at several thousand websites. So it just,
We talked about, I think the last time we talked about a movie like this, it was the Batman movie with Michael Keaton. You know, we talked about that was 89, and you know, you had the people seeing the merchandise and the Happy Meal stuff go up on sale before the movie came out, and you really had no way of knowing other than a couple of trailers, you know, what you were seeing, but there was so much anticipation. And that's the, I think that was the last movie before this one I could think of that had such a, you know, just a crowd queuing up and excited to see something like this. Was this a, was this a summertime release or was it around Christmas? I couldn't remember.
No, it was released like all the Star Wars movies on in May. So this was released on May 19th, 1999. Yeah, just a couple of days removed from the.
Wow.
So today's actually the release date of Empire Strikes Back too. Like they all kind of release on that May period. Yeah, so a lot of anniversaries in May. Star Wars anniversaries May. But it had a $115 million budget. It was, of course, written and directed by George Lucas. So interesting thing about this is, you know, he catches a lot of grief for this movie, obviously. You talked about the anticipation level. And I think the cool thing about this movie is it is both the blessing and the curse of this movie. you know, I think the reason a lot of people had heartburn with this is because it just didn't live up to the expectations,
which were entirely unrealistic. Right.
What could possibly live up to this, you know?
Yeah.
If one thing I've known about Star Wars fans is that, you know, they're always waiting for the next thing to be disappointed by, you know? So they wait and they wait and they wait and they get something that doesn't match their fan fiction and there's a letdown. And then the next, they just start the cycle all over again, and they ultimately come back to the thing they hated, and they love it again. So, I think that's kind of where we fall with Phantom Menace now. So, we'll try to flesh that out in this episode, and probably pick up a few other things on the way. So as I mentioned, George Lucas was the singular vision for this, kind of like Ed Wood was back in his day, Mike. But
good comparison.
In hindsight, a lot of the research that you know I've looked at, it's you know. Lucas did not want to direct these movies. He was kind of regarded that he was a little not confident really in his ability to direct. He hadn't directed a movie since the original Star Wars. So this was, you know, it's been quite a while since he had been in that director's chair, and he's been historically known for, you know, being kind of hard to work for. A lot of actors had some issues with the way his directing style. So he really didn't want to direct these things. And he really trying to hand it off to his buddies, Spielberg, Ron Howard, Robert Zemeckis. He pleaded with those guys to take their director's reins. And of course those guys are going to say, you know, no way, this is your vision. I don't trust it. You've got to do it. So not only did he not want to direct this movie, he didn't want to write the script either. he begged and begged Lawrence Kasdan, who was the original screenwriter for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And he got the same kind of response. He said, no, George, you know, we know you've been sitting on this. So he wanted to make this movie for all those years, but didn't want to get in the writer director. But he kind of sourced himself out on that one, kind of pigeonholed himself and had him do the whole thing. So
help me not bust a myth, but just maybe, I don't know, help me understand. Back in, say, early 70s, mid 70s, did he really have, say, the basic outline for the Phantom Menace kind of in his head? Like, obviously, he started off with 4, 5, and 6, but how much of 1, 2, 3 did he have kind of sketched in his mind?
Well, you know the old adage that the press uses, when it comes between truth and legend, print the legend.
Correct.
But yeah, for the most part, he had, you know, when he first released this, he wanted to do this sprawling 9-part, which would become the known as the Skywalker saga.
Okay.
So it had several iterations. You know, a lot of the stuff in this movie was kind of penciled in for Star Wars 4, the 77 release. Some of the elements of this film were originally supposed to be incorporated into that.
Oh,
okay. But I think some of the technology and it was just kind of the stuff he wanted to do was unfilmable. And I think that's why, you know, we had this long wait, you know, 16 right. years since Return of the Jedi to go to the next phase. And I felt he essentially him and his team at LucasArts kind of invented the technology to make this, and boy, did they take advantage of it. This whole movie is just pretty much there's some practical effects in here, but the entire thing's essentially digital.
Yeah.
For better or for worse. You know, so. But yeah, so as I mentioned, it was released in May of 1999 to some fanfare. it notoriously was tied to a lot of people getting pulled out of school. A lot of kids were intentionally pulled out of school by their parents to go see this movie with them. It was called the Star Wars Flu, or the Wookiee Hookie was my favorite. And market analysts estimated that about $293 million of lost American productivity was a result of people skipping out to see this on that day. But people were, you know, they were so psyched to see this. They would leave people's deathbeds to go see this movie. They were just so ramped up. So I remember the first time I saw this movie. Mike, you and I did not know each other at the time.
No,
I recall.
Sir. This is.
Before
2000
seems like forever. Seems,
I know, right?
Yes. So yeah, for those that are curious, Mike and I kind of met our wives, our respective wives set us up on what can only be called a play date. I remember my wife so unceremoniously saying, "Hey, I want you to meet my friend's husband. He's funny. He likes movies and he likes sports just like you." Just like, I felt like I was talking to like a third grader. We hooked up, Mike, and we saw the wrestling movie, right? Beyond the Mat. Was that the first movie?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you're right. Diamond Dallas Page.
We kind of combined our two loves of cinema and professional wrestling.
Jake the Snake
Roberts.
Foley,
right? Yeah, Jake the Snake, yeah.
Yeah, 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 okay.
A fun little documentary about the real
oh my gosh.
Aspects of professional wrestling. Yeah. But yeah, it's been a hetero love fest ever since. But me and Mike did not see this movie together. I saw it with an extremely disinterested wife. She's not a Star Wars fan, but she and typically I go to a lot of movies by myself. I don't really have a problem with that. But this was one I wanted someone to share the experience with, Mike. So I asked her to, and she begrudgingly accepted. And I think I saw this at opening day at a weird time, like 9:10 in the morning or something like that. And my takeaway from this movie, I'll never forget to this day. You know, I saw it in suburban Charlotte, and you know, Charlotte's a banking city. And as we sit down, as the trailers are running, I think a crew of about 12 banking bros walked in with their suits and ties still on. And they had sat down a few rows ahead of us, and they were psyched and they were pumped. And as we were getting settled in, I noticed this matronly woman walks in behind them about 10 minutes later. And she walks down to the aisles, and she's where they're sitting, and she folds her arms and just starts glaring at them. And it comes to find out that she was the bank manager, their supervisor. My God. So she had gone to buy a ticket and then to go in and to scold these guys. Apparently they left work unauthorized, and to her credit, she stood up there and made them all leave, and they all had to kind of like walk past her in shame. But
that's crazy.
I just thought that was funny. I almost felt bad for him for a few minutes, even though their combined salaries were probably enough to subsidize the making of this film. But some things never change, Mike. They got busted. Mike, when was you remember the first time you saw this one?
Hang on.
Where'd you see this one first?
I'm still getting over Wookiee Hookie right now. I might have seen it the same theater you saw, but obviously the hype wasn't for me. So I remember seeing it not the first weekend, but at least into the second week, you know, and it was, we're a little bit different. My wife was the one who wanted to see it more than I did probably. So yeah, she, uh-huh. she likes the Star Wars movies, so she was very excited about it. And I remember enjoying the movie, but thinking it didn't quite feel like Star Wars to me, and that was just my initial reaction. That's all I can remember from, you know.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, that was a common criticism for sure.
Yeah.
So like I said, this year, I mean, all the other releases got out of the way because they knew this is just going to be the set piece for 1999. There's a lot of good movies in 1999. You had Austin Powers, you had The Matrix, you had Blair Witch, you had, it was a big year, but all those big blockbuster movies just steered clear in May. They just said, you know what, we're out. George is all yours. Take over for a while. And this movie just was in, you know, the top spot for months and months and months. So, but people were just so ready to get back into that, groove and start watching all this new content for these things they had grown up with. So had the same kind of theme, but a whole bunch of new faces with a whole new cast. So Mike, who's in this movie, Mike?
Oh, who's in this movie? Let's see. Well, I'll go just as they went in the cast. Liam Neeson, he has a certain set of skills, and he was in one of my favorite movies, underrated, Darkman. I don't know if you ever saw it. Great movie.
Sam Raimi. Yeah, nice pull. Yeah.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yes, Ewan McGregor.
He took this role. He took this role without even reading the script. He just said, you know, whatever, George, I'm in. Didn't even read the script.
Crazy. Yeah. Ewan McGregor, talked about him earlier. I knew him from Trainspotting. Other than that, I couldn't remember at the time what else he had been in before this, but great Scottish actor. Natalie Portman, opposite. Yep. She's not a great actress. Kind of wooden. At the time, yeah. Maybe it's gotten a little better. She may or may not currently be ripped and buff for her new role in the Thor movie. That's still debatable.
A little freaky, you're right.
Yeah. Let's see who else. So we got that. Jake Lloyd. Jake Lloyd, who this is the only movie I think he was in. Obviously, he was our titular Anakin Skywalker character. Left acting after this movie. Later got arrested.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Later got arrested for cruising down the I-95 in South Carolina, of all places. Let's see. Oh, Samuel Jackson. He's pretty darn good in this movie, I have to say. And Frank Oz is doing Yoda. He's one of the few recurring characters, along with Anthony Daniels and Kenny Baker, I think, is R2-D2. Yeah. And I want to give a shout out to Terrence Stamp, one of our few returning podcast actors. Who I don't understand. Wow, what a weak role he had in this movie. Oh my gosh, what an ineffectual character. I have no idea why he was in this movie. The rest of the cast is some strange creatures who get just enough screen time to sell figures.
That's a good way to put it. So yeah, so that's the lineup. They took the reins with Lucas's script and tried to kickstart the franchise. So let's just get into it, Mike. You ready to do it?
Yes, sir.
Hit the button, Mike. So the movie opens up. Of course, you get that title card, you know, a long time ago in the galaxy far, far away. And just that alone got the crowd that I was with screaming. It was kind of like a pressure valve at open mic. They were just so happy to get through there.
And then they start reading trade routes and taxation.
You're a little worried. You beat me to it. Yeah, so you get iconic John Williams score kind of smacks you in the face in a good way, and the Star Wars theme comes up, and you get that scroll, and the first paragraph it says there's a taxation of local trade routes. You're thinking, oh, thrilling! This is what I'm in for, right? But it turns out this
Senate endlessly debates.
Yeah, so we got C-SPAN, great, you know, but so that. This small planet Naboo has got a trade blockade around it, and the chancellor, that is the aforementioned Terrence Stamp, leader of the Galactic Senate, dispatches these two ambassadors to kind of broker the trade dispute. So right now, you know, here we go, pew pew pew, right, Mike? So they're out to negotiate a trade dispute. It's Qui-Gon Jinn, played by Liam Neeson, and then the young Obi-Wan Kenobi, who is his apprentice. played by Ewan McGregor. So they land on this Trade Federation ship, and they're met by this kind of C-3PO looking droid that kind of Hosa puts him in the lobby. And I'm thinking of like Frank from Godfather 2. He's got me waiting in the lobby. You can't get in to see Mike?
Canopies.
Chop liver. But yeah, so she tells him to wait in the lobby, and she goes back and talks to these giant, they're called Nemodians, Mike. And apparently they're from the planet Chinatown, because they've got this weird, yeah. So just to call back my wife and her lack of interest in Star Wars, as I'm doing my research for the show, she walks by during this scene and she goes, "Why do those guys look like basset hounds?" And I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" She goes, "With the long ears." I said, "No, that's part of their hats." So she just kind of grinned non-dismissingly and went back to her cell phone, right, looking at her Poshmark stuff, and was never to be seen or heard again.
I'm going to interrupt you a couple of times. I apologize. First question. Trade Federation. Yeah. What these guys, and you see, what are the Numidians or whatever they're called? Viceroy, as I know.
Yeah.
Their civilization exists in just trading. Is that what I'm gathering? Are they the Trade Federation, this whole race, or is it like the Empire?
They're kind of like our, you know, Department of Commerce. They just kind of, you know, the entire galaxy, however, you know.
Okay. All right. So
I may be a Star Wars junkie, but there's a lot of stuff even I don't understand about this movie. Particularly, like, you know, why is signing this treaty so? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But
wasn't Naboo?
I don't
so
understand
key?
Palpatine's giant. He's doing the long play here, Mike. He's got a long plan to kind of seize power.
Okay.
And I don't understand why the most powerful Dark Lord of the Sith needs to worry about, you know, treaties and trade routes, but. But maybe we'll figure it out. Maybe we'll come to the realization. We'll just keep going. So this protocol droid tells these two bad guys that, hey, you know, bad news. These ambassadors are Jedi Knights, and they freak out. So she kind of tells on them, and then they bring up the little hologram of this hooded dark figure called Dark Sidious. Says, "Hey, dude, it's a Jedi. What are we supposed to do?" He says, "Well, kill him." You know, so they decide that they'll just kind of gas him out in the waiting room. So they turn on the gas, and then find out right away that the Jedis are like Batman. They've got a utility belt. They've got like a rebreather that they just put on, and so they dispatch these the droid army, which I think heretofore became called Clankers, Mike, the little droid army robots.
Yeah, is it just me or the battle droids? Or they're like more ineffectual than stormtroopers? I mean, good gosh!
Yeah, they wow. couldn't. Yeah, they like, couldn't find. Wow,
their aim. They're robots. Like, you know. These are robots. Their aim is horrible. How's this? How do they pull this off?
How about some programming? Yeah, they make stormtroopers seem like Navy SEALs.
Yeah, at least
they open up the door.
Yeah. It's just amazing. I mean, you could say stormtroopers.
How about programming some aiming programs and whatever. But I think we're digging too deep.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
So they open up the doors, and they see this fog, and then you see that blue and green lightsaber light up, and right there, I mean, that at this point as a Star Wars fan, I'm in. You know, you see the music kick in, and the lightsabers go on. I guess I understand why they use droids for the villains in this movie, because it really kind of utilizes the abilities of the lightsaber. I think hacking people in half, like human life forms, that might not play as well. So, you know, no one cares if you slice up a toaster. But so you got to see all this cool saber stuff. So they get their ride, of course, is the first thing to get exploded. So they're stuck there. So they kind of hack and slash their way down to the bowels of the ship and see that there's just a giant invasion army down there. So they kind of stow away on those giant ship, and they kind of hitch a ride down to Naboo. And as they're doing that, the Nemodians, the Viceroys, they bring up on the screen, the view screen there, the Queen Amidala, saying that, "Hey, you know, haha, you have to leave now." She says, "What are you talking about? There's no one here." So they're getting gaslit. But there's an invasion pending, so they're on their way down. So they get down to the surface of Naboo, Mike, and this is where we get introduced to, going to get it out there, Mike, Jar Jar Binks.
There he is.
a point of contention in this, let's say, to say the least, right? But as they're running away, they literally run into Jar Jar Binks, and Jar Jar is a local Gungan. There's two civilizations that live on Naboo. There's the Naboo people, and there's the Gungans, who live kind of, I guess they live in the water. but so Mike, how did you feel about Jar Jar?
I'll tell you what, I'm impressed that he's all done digitally. You know, he's considered the first, digital character ever had in a movie. There's your point there. But I tell you what, you watch this movie with subtitles and you see some of his vocabulary.
Oh, I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Wasn't it wonderful?
It made it 10 times worse to actually read it and hear it. Why? Why?
Yeah,
George,
you know,
why?
Yeah. So I think, you know, having the singular vision is both, you know, a good thing for the movie and I think a bad thing, because I don't think he had enough people around him to say, hey, George, to pull him aside. George, you know, you feel good about this one? He got accused of some racial stereotyping, and he made some questionable decisions, Mike. And I think, you know,
I
think enough has been said about that. But
yeah, and it goes deeper than that. I mean, just there's comedy relief and there's just, you know, eye-rolling, groaning relief. I mean, this was, it just got tiresome. When the scene where Liam Neeson, like, drugs him off, you know, and like, shuts him up, I'm like, and Ian McGregor's like, I think you're a little hard on him. I was like, no, do it again.
You overdid it.
Yeah, do it
well,
again.
Well, I think it's important to point out here that, you know, again, I'm a Star Wars guy, and I always will be, regardless of the content. But the people that got really vehemently opposed to Jar Jar and all that, I think it's an important thing to point out here that a lot of people hate Jar Jar Binks. But you know who doesn't hate Jar Jar Binks? The audience that it was intended
kids.
For. Kids. Yeah. Kids love this character. And at the end of the day, no matter how hard people want to be, these movies are made for children.
they
were in 1977. These are callbacks. Lucas has said this. These are literally callbacks to the serial movies he saw in theaters when he's a kid. You know, the Flash Gordons and all those things.
Yeah.
These are things.
There's always a goofy sidekick that did silly stuff.
The double feature on Saturday. The double feature on Saturday matinee. That's what he wanted to recapture with this franchise. But.
Right.
But anyway, through some plot devices, they hook up with Jar Jar Binks, and he says, you know, there's a big invasion coming. We need help. And he says, well, I can get you to Naboo, but there's a big city, Gunga City, Mike, is underwater. So he decides, I'll take you home with me, even though he's not welcome there, we find out. But so they put on their little breathing apparatus, and they kind of swim. They basically just jump in a small farm pond, and then the next thing you know, they're swimming into
deep water,
giant underwater kingdom. They get to the
They get down there. I have a geography question problem. They go to Gungans. Uh-huh. They go to Gungan City, and apparently they land along with the battle droids who are going to invade Naboo and go to the palace. But when they get to Gungan City, they go through the core to warn the palace ahead of the invasion army. And I'm thinking, okay, that means the invasion army landed on the exact opposite side of the planet from where they were going to go. Why would they do that?
See, Mike, you're treading down a dangerous path here.
I'm sorry. Anyway, sorry.
I can't explain it. I won't try.
I'll abstain.
But yeah, they get to this underwater kingdom, and they come across the big boss, Boss Nass, Mike. He's this big fatter version of Jar Jar Binks. And I only bring him up because he's played by the actor Brian Blessed. For those that may not know him, he's
Flash Gordon,
big, bulky, lovable Prince Fulton.
Yes.
He's voiced by that character.
I did not know that.
So they bring him in. They say, well, Jar Jar's been banished. He shouldn't have brought you here in the first place. Y'all can just leave. And they do a little Jedi mind trick to get a free ride. And you think, okay, well, that we get rid of Jar Jar now. But of course, for some reason, Jar Jar has to stay. I guess Liam Neeson thinks he'll be a good navigator, Mike. and that as it turns out, you know, that was a great idea, because all he did was just scream and yell. Yeah,
he does not help them at all.
They end up.
They use the force to go through the planet.
they literally had to drug him to get him to shut up because he compromised the mission so bad. So, so, you know, nice direction, Jar Jar. But yeah, they, so we, Mike mentioned the geographic inconsistencies, but they end up, you know, it's pretty, it's kind of a cool scene. You've never seen this in Star Wars before.
I like the fish.
They're kind of, they've got this little submarine type ship and they're going through the core, driving to Naboo, and they're attacked by these large aquatic creatures, which is kind of an interesting thing. But they ultimately end up getting, they surface up at the capital city, Naboo, which you think, you know, why didn't the droid ships just land there? I don't know why they decided to park on the other side of the planet.
I don't know.
And they caught off really quick too, didn't they, Mike?
Yeah.
By the time they get to the surface to get to Naboo to warn the queen, the droid army is already there, and they've already captured Queen Amidala and her council. So of course, when the Jedi arrive, it's more hack and slash, and you know, bicycle kicks and karate and all that kind of cool stuff, and they take out, you know, the entire invasion army is pretty much taken out, but they take Natalie Portman's Padme Amidala and her crew and put her on the queen's ship, and they escape. So and as they're doing that, some of the residual ships that are still in the blockade ships, they kind of shoot and damage the ship. So this is where we get our first kind of like questionable callbacks or needless callbacks. So as the ship's getting damaged, we see all these little mech astrodroids going out on the surface and trying to fix the repair. And of course, for R2-D2's there, Mike, and he's the cute little boy. He goes out there and he fixes the ship without getting shot, and he's the hero. But they still, their ship is still damaged because their hyperdrive is damaged. So they decide that we got to find a place to land. We got to make a pit stop and get this thing fixed. So conveniently, this little sandy planet called Arrakis is there. No, Dune, sorry. No, Tatooine.
Tatooine. Yeah.
So they land on Tatooine. They start looking for, you know, a junk dealer. So what's interesting here also, Mike, is that Queen Amidala, there's a bit of a misdirect here.
Oh, yes.
The figure that they're talking to is the queen's decoy, played by the lovely Keira Knightley. One of the few actresses that doesn't have to fake an English accent. But yeah, Keira Knightley looks so much like Natalie Portman that, you know, people on the set can literally not tell the difference when they're in full costume. So they land on Tatooine. They say, well, maybe we can find a local junk dealer to get the parts we need, because there's no auto zones on Tatooine, Mike. You got to find a real.
No O'Reilly's?
Real place to go. No O'Reilly's. So Liam Neeson takes a small little crew, and Padme wants to go with him. So he doesn't want that. Of course, they bring Jar Jar along, Mike, because course they do. Because he's, you know,
he needs to step in poo, and he needs to do a fart joke.
Yeah, it was funny, right? So I don't think George spent a lot of time at Second City or any kind of comedy writing training, but so he just went to the cheap gags. But so they come across this you know, junk dealer, this wonderful little creature called Watto. Like, his junk shop. He's kind of like a little flying rat, and I think he's voiced by Triumph, the insult comic dog. Charming little beast.
Awesome.
And a great plot device here. His little rat brain isn't affected by the by Jedi powers. Mind tricks don't affect him, Mike. You know, when you see this magnificent beast, you think, here's a miracle of evolution that can't even be swayed by Jedi powers. But they're trying to buy parts, and they've only got, you know, galactic credits. He says, well, that doesn't matter out here. That don't mean anything. I need money. Of course, Qui-Gon doesn't have any cash. So they say, okay. So it's back to the drawing board. So as they leave, they see this little boy in the shop, a little slave boy, who essentially does all the work for Watto. And we find out that this is a little Anakin, Mike.
Little Annie.
Yeah. So this is our first introduction to little Jake Lloyd. You had mentioned his other movie prior to this was, I think, Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger. He played the little kid in that Christmas romp. I think he was only 9 years old at the time. So the Star Wars fan base is toxic enough to not—they're not beyond attacking a 9-year-old actor.
Well,
so
yeah,
they, of course, you know, attached all their
venom
to him.
It's just funny that we watched a movie like The Shining last time, and that kid was great. Yeah. you know.
Yeah.
And I thought for a kid actor, and that was in 1980, and you know, I thought he was great. And
yeah,
I mean, I understand it,
but
I just don't. But, I think there should have been
Olivier himself.
Yeah, I think somebody should have told George Lucas, you know, maybe pick someone else.
Maybe a little miscast, but you know, yeah. To be fair, you know, I mean, Laurence Olivier himself could have read some of these lines, and it wouldn't
excellent
go.
Point.
they're introduced to him. They just kind of go on their way. But, you know, Qui-Gon gets a little blip on his radar. Something's going on with this little kid. So as they're walking back to town, a big sandstorm kicks up. And, you know, they meet this little bastard on the street. And that's not derogatory. He is in fact, little and, in fact, a bastard, Mike. So, he says, you know, come back to my...
Yeah, I don't want to get ahead of you, but who is his dad in Star Wars lore? Who is he supposed to be like?
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
We're going to get to that, Mike.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. One of the questionable things that Lucas did here is he took kind of the mysticism and the religious aspect out of the Force, and he tried to, like, he had the concept of the midichlorians, Mike. So when they... After the pod race, Qui-Gon takes some blood samples from Anakin, sends them to Obi-Wan, and it turns out that the Force is actually some sort of viral infection. But midichlorians are things that generate the Force, and that whole concept kind of went away right after the blowback from the fan base. But when he has a conversation with she says that there was no father, and he suspects it was an immaculate conception, Mike. So the assumption by Qui-Gon is that the midichlorians created him, and they used the Shmi's body as the vessel. He may have been completely manifested by the midichlorians, thus suggesting that he's the one that could bring balance to the Force.
Like I said.
So he invites him home to his little hut where he's at. They're introduced to his mom, Shmi, Mike. Yeah. So he brings him, he gives him shelter under the storm, and he's kind of showing off his little droid he's building, which, of course, again, kind of a groany callback. He's building C-3PO, Mike.
Of course he is.
Yeah. So.
Member berries.
So he's trying to, like, show off and impress Natalie Portman. So yeah, there's more out of that later. But they're sitting around eating dinner, and they're having a conversation about how they're going to get cash. And, you know, little Anakin says, well, conveniently there's a big pod race the next day. And a pod race is kind of it's literally just that. They hook up a pod to two rocket engines, and it's kind of like a Death Race 3000. Race. So but that's big for gamblers and stuff like that. And he says, well, I'm human, I'm the only human that can do it, and I'd be happy to enter in this race. I've been conveniently building a pod racer all this time. He says, I could win the race, and you guys could have the cash to buy the parts you need. And as he's telling him this conversation, Qui-Gon's starting to understand that the kid is force sensitive, and he's got a lot of special powers, and you know, Obi-Wan's blind to it for some reason, but Qui-Gon says, you know, there's something about this kid. So in a completely, you know, irresponsible move, they said, okay, well, this 9-year-old can get in this death race and try to win us cash so we can go back home. So that opens up to this big set piece. The major set piece in the middle of the movie here is the pod race, Mike. And it's almost like a 10-minute scene.
Yeah.
It's a big scene.
It's the Ben-Hur chariot scene.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Yeah, so this is a really cool scene, but it had a few drawbacks. So it's kind of like a NASCAR event, Mike. It's hot, it's dirty, it's loud, and there's a lot of alien life forms in the stands. But
apparently they have pole positions apparently too. That surprised me. I didn't realize Anakin had to qualify.
so they got to go. They got to go three laps around this deadly track. And you know, it's the scenes in this movie are really cool from a special effects standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
The speed and the crash physics are really cool. So when they're actually racing, this is kind of cool. But what kind of the groany part here is when they cut away for all the comic relief during this thing. You know, all the kind of slapstick humor and the we see that the Jabba's there. You know,
of course.
Jabba came to the race, and he actually even brought the wife, Mike.
Yeah, she was hot. The screen is
his hot dumpy wife is in the background, just kind of watching the whole thing, is as interested as my wife is when she's watching Star Wars. But the effects of this were really cool. And it, you know, of course, Anakin wins the race, and they had kind of prior to this, they had kind of double crossed Watto to kind of over bet and overcommit, and as a result of that, they won the race, won the on the cash, and managed to win the freedom for one of the slaves. In this case, Anakin was a slave, and they won his freedom to take Anakin back. So as they decide that Qui-Gon wants to bring Anakin back to the Jedi Temple to see, because he feels that there's something about this kid. So he had this heartfelt scene where he has to leave his mother and go, because you know they didn't win her freedom, and so they say their goodbyes and head out. So as they're doing this, we get introduced to Darth Maul, Mike, the apprentice for Darth Sidious. And when I first saw Darth Maul on the theater, I said, okay, this is going to be amazing. This is cool. This guy is great. He's cool. This is really cool. There's going to be 3 movies with this guy. I can't wait to see where this is going. but he's been tracking them on this desert planet. So, of course, as they're going back to the ship to leave, Darth Maul tries to do a drive-by on Anakin. And then there's this very brief fight where Qui-Gon and Maul have a little lightsaber duel in the desert, and then you know they end that by him just running away as quick as they can, so that not only do they have a new Jedi, potential Jedi, they also, you know, the Sith have been unveiled to the Jedi, and that does that. So some bad things are going, right, Mike?
Oh yeah.
So as they're going back to they go back to the Jedi Council, which is on a planet called Coruscant. It's an entire city is on the entire planet is just one big city. And there's a kind of little 2 things that happen here. One is that Anakin gets introduced by the 2 Jedi to the Jedi Council, and this is where we see odd cast of characters sitting around the bench. There, we get to see our puppetized Yoda. The movie release, he was a puppet, and I think not until like 2011's Blu-ray release they digitized him. They did a digital version of Yoda to look a little bit better. But the puppet in the theater was really terrible. Kind of looked like a shaved Oscar the Grouch. But none of the guys on the council are really hip to Anakin being. They sense something weird. They can't quite put their finger on it, but they know the kid's bad news. But of course, Qui-Gon's kind of a rogue. Decides, well, you know what? I'm going to kind of disobey and just hang on to this kid for a while. And then the other part of this, when they're back on Coruscant, is this kind of weird. As I mentioned, kind of Star Wars C-SPAN play out where there's they vote the chance where poor General Zod gets displaced for a vote of no confidence, and Senator Palpatine takes over. You can start to see there's some sort of political thing at play here as well. So at the end of all that is that Natalie Portman's, even though she just got this, you know what, I got to go back to home because my people are getting attacked and I need to be there for them. So they kind of head back. So, and that kind of sets up the third act, Mike. And the third act is just, it's kind of a mess. There's 3 storylines going here, but it's essentially the giant invasion. So they, it's kind of fought. And there's kind of 3 storylines. One is there's a straight out of the Star Wars playbook, there's a space battle to take out the mothership to kind of deactivate the whole thing.
Gotta have that.
So there's an invading army. That's with the Naboo and the Gungans make an alliance, and they kind of fight their planet in this battle. The battle droids and then kind of stand off, and that's kind of a cool scene. That's kind of ground combat, and of course, you know, Jar Jar is a general.
somehow
that came into play. So he's in charge of maybe he did something to deserve that that we didn't see, I don't know, but he's a hot mess the entire time. He can't do anything right, yet he continues to he probably kills like half the army by himself, but through no fault of his own. And then you have the stuff in the Naboo capital where the Jedi face off against this Darth Maul character. So that of course is that's the highlight of this last set piece, is that those Jedi and Sith battles on the lightsaber. That's what everybody remembers about this movie.
Yeah, that was the take home for me was the two Jedis taking on Sith.
Yeah, and then, you know, you get that amazing John Williams score, the Duel of the Fates, the stuff, you know, and when he opens the door and he drops his cloak and then both, you know, sides of the lightsaber light up, the double lightsaber.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, how could you not like that, right? So they have this amazing fight, and there's this ground battle where the Gungans are fighting the droid army with these blue yoga balls. So I guess that's their dangerous thing. But in the middle of all this, Anakin was told to kind of hide in a spaceship and not come out. And of course, the autopilot kicks in, and of course, R2-D2 is in the ship,
of course,
and he can't deactivate the autopilot until he's up in the air. Little Anakin feels compelled to kind of narrate everything he's doing, and this is what I liked best about the pod race scene, Mike, is not to sound too pretentious, but that's the first time you see this little 9-year-old boy. He's not chatting. He's not talking. He's serious. He's like driven, and he's mean. And
right.
He's focused, and he can say, okay, well, I can see that as Darth Vader.
I don't think he says one word during the whole race scene. You know,
he doesn't, and that's what's kind of cool about it. He says, okay, this is what he's really capable of.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when he gets up in space, he's, you know,
spinning. That seems like
everything.
A cool
everything he says, spinning. Yeah, this is podcasting. So, yeah, everything he says in that ship, I just wanted to reach through the screen and punch him. But he conveniently lands on the flight deck of this thing, and as his starfighter is kind of overheated, and he as he's pushing the buttons to fire back up, he conveniently hits the proton torpedoes. And conveniently, his ship is lined up with the nuclear generator, which and of course he takes out the engine, and all the droids on the planet go limp, and then the battle's over, and he gets out, of course, just in time, and that leads us to kind of wrap up the last bit of the movie where the Maul and Qui-Gon are fighting. And it's kind of a 2-on-1, kind of an unfair fight, really, Mike, until they get to a little area.
And force field.
In the energy transfer room. And for the first time, they kind of get separated. So Qui-Gon and Ewan, and Qui-Gon's forced to fight like a man, 1-on-1. And then at this point, we see Darth Maul kills Qui-Gon, which is, you know, no one was really kind of expecting that. But he gets taken out. And then that just unleashes the beast for Obi-Wan. So as soon as the trap door is open, he comes in. It's just some of the greatest fight choreography I've seen in a long time. This is straight up Jackie Chan quality, great stuff. Some of the fight choreography in this scene is amazing. And Obi-Wan's kind of rage takes over, and he gets in this great fight with Darth Maul. Darth Maul kind of force pushes him over the ledge, and he's hanging on there. And then he figures out that Qui-Gon's lightsaber is still over there, so he does a little, you know, yoga flip, and Flying Zucchini Brothers lands over and kind of slashes Darth Maul in half, and he falls down this chasm. And, you know, when this happened, I'm like, oh, come on. You did not just kill – you killed Darth Maul now? Because he's only got 6 minutes of screen time, Mike.
I know. That was
– Jar Jar's got four times that.
I thought he would get injured and then like fly away or limp away or something, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, and they just so disappointed. I think so much opportunity with that character, and they just kind of.
I definitely wouldn't think he would show up in a Han Solo movie many years later.
That's a subject for later. You know, Disney has decided that no one really has to die in any of their movies. Well, they took over all the Marvel stuff. Everybody dies, but not really. In Star Wars, everybody dies, but not really. So, I mean, there's no real tension left anymore. I don't know if it's just a generational thing, but, you know, when you watch Jaws, Quint dies, and Quint doesn't come back.
Yes.
There's, in Jaws 2, there's no Quint. There's no mechanized Quint. There's no Quint's ghost. It's okay to have characters die in a movie. I don't understand why the trend is to... I don't know if they think the generation's too soft. I don't get it, but
right.
Yeah. But of course, you know, everybody comes back, Mike. But yeah, so the movie's kind of wrapped up there, and you know, at the end, you know, Obi-Wan runs over to Qui-Gon's. You know, his last wishes are that he take Anakin as his apprentice, and so, you know, it's a dying wish. You got to do it, right, Mike? So
Padawan.
That's so the end scene. You have his funeral, and then, you know, you see, you know, Qui-Gon's funeral, you see, you know, little Anakin's got his little, he's got his buzz cut, his Jedi buzz cut. And he's he's part of the tribe now. And we can't end on that bummer. So they have a nice, some weird little parade.
Oh, yeah. And Chewbacca doesn't get his medal on this one either.
He does not. He still does not get his medal. Speaking of Chewbacca, there are no Wookiees in this movie, which I thought was a, you know. Remember the time we saw Peter Mayhew in Atlanta?
That's right. That dude liked to smoke.
Dude, yeah, let me tell you something, folks. The phrase "never meet your idols." Sometimes that's a true thing. Me and Mike got to see Peter Mayhew smoking cigarettes outside of the Hilton. It had one of his handlers like brushing his hair for him. It was just a weird thing to see. Mm-hmm. To this day, but hey, we saw the guy who was in Star Wars. So that's kind of cool.
There you go.
But yeah, so that movie kind of wraps up, and then I remember people walking out of the theater. There were people that were like, "Wow, that was great," and then it was about half of them were like, "What did I just see? You know, why do I feel this way?" you could just see it in their eyes, right?
Yeah,
right?
It was a mixed feeling, mixed bag.
But needless to say, I mean, this thing was gigantor. It ended up making $474 million. It was, you know, reached 1 billion worldwide and had a $65 million opening weekend. So you don't get those numbers unless a lot of people see it two times, right? And this is back in 1999 when there's, you know, real movies and real competition. But so, you know, everybody knew that he had signed on for three. So there's a lot of hesitancy. I think by the time the second one came out, Mike, you and I had known each other. Yep. And I think we went to the midnight show of Attack of the Clones, right? Yep. Yeah, and I remember to this day, I'll never forget when we went to a midnight show. And I think what surprised me most is ridiculously drunk people in the audience already was the theater manager came out. Remember what he said, Mike? "Guys, we've seen this movie and it doesn't suck." And everybody went crazy because everybody was psyched to see this next one. But there were some reservations. You know, everybody was kind of cautious and nervous about, you know, because they had been kind of burned on the first one. But so it was huge. But it just had this, you know, the sequels, of course, the Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, and then the paved the way for the sequel trilogy after the Disney acquisition of LucasArts material. But this was the first movie that Star Wars movie that did not get any Oscars, Mike.
No special effects Oscar, yeah. Really.
No, none of the, at least on the technical categories, none of them were won. Oh. But, you know, MTV, we always go back to MTV, Mike. They did take away the popcorn for the best action sequence. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, whew, thank goodness for that, huh?
It beat out the end scene of Blair Witch. I've seen the Blair Witch Project. They classified the last scene in Blair as an action scene.
Wow.
So, again, nice job, MTV. Keep filming that team, Mom.
I guess so.
But this movie had, you know, the fallout is legendary. People have more than one occasion voiced their displeasure about this. It led to some serious PTSD for both Jake Lloyd and Ahmed Best. The vitriol from the fan base really kind of isolated these guys and really kind of pushed them out of the business. So, 20 years later, it's still there. But people have really, I think the trend now is that people have kind of warmed up to these prequel trilogies a little more. As I mentioned, now they've kind of shifted their hate to the sequel trilogies, the J.J. Abrams stuff. They've kind of misplaced some of their displeasure with these movies now. So, you know, 15 years from now, they'll come back and say how great, you know, Adam Driver was and how good The Last Jedi was. But for now, they've taken the reins as kind of the angry fan base, kind of focusing their opinion on those guys. Yeah. So, wow, that was a lot to unpack. Feel like we just went back 20 years. Let's go through the grumpy meter a little bit, Mike. So as I mentioned, you know, my affinity to Star Wars has no bounds. So I try to go outside my body and look at this, you know, from a different perspective. And I thought, you know, okay, well, it's when I walked out of the theater the first time, I was immune to the external factors. And I said, okay, five out of five, I'm hooked. Let's see the next one. Looking at it now as an older, more cynical guy, I don't really move much. I probably dropped down to like a 4 out of 5, Mike, but this is just still something that it just represents a good time for me in my life. You know, it was kind of an enjoyable thing. You don't get that feeling in movies anymore. And I think that's really, I'm kind of blinded by that doctrine there. That's, they don't make movies like this anymore. You know, whether they're good or bad, the experience you have with this, it just kind of trumps all the other aspects of this for me, but I will go down a little bit because, you know, you can see some of the things they could have done better. But, you know, my complaint with people that hate this movie is it's typically focused on Lucas and how Lucas betrayed them. Lucas doesn't owe you guys anything. And I guess that's an adult opinion that I've kind of fostered over the years, is like, you know, these movies aren't made for me, but I like them anyway. And there should be no entitlement for Star Wars fans. You know, Lucas has given you guys enough. You're not entitled to anything better. If you don't like it, it's probably on you. So anyway, that's my jaded opinion on it, Mike. But maybe you have something. Maybe you have a different view.
Like I said before, I wasn't a big Star Wars fan. So when I went to see it, I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the visuals. And the story, it was okay. But like I said, this is going on my past memory. I would say about 4 stars at the time. Looking at it now, though, I mean, that's why I love this podcast, is because looking at it now, luckily I've seen parts of this movie since that first watch. So I really hadn't seen the whole thing before. So when I'm watching it this time, I'm like, I really didn't want to see it. You know, it was the perennial, like, I've got a bad feeling about this. But it's like, well, you know, it can't be that bad. You know, it's, like I said, the visuals I remembered. I remember seeing Darth Maul, and, you know, like, wow, I can't wait to see that scene. You know, pod racing, maybe not.
Yeah.
I got to first off apologize to the Disney sequel a little bit. I don't like those movies that much, but after watching this, No, two of the main reasons a lot of the Star Wars fans don't like the Disney movies was the tone and the fact of the member berries kind of, the bringing back the old characters just to have them, you know. And I'm watching this movie, right, and I'm thinking, wait, there's Jabba, there's Tusken Raiders, there's C-3PO, there's R2-D2, of course. And I'm watching this going, wait, Lucas did this before Disney, you know. And then there's the
shoehorn those in.
Yeah. And then this, as far as the tone, you know, the humor, you know, that's what a lot of people don't like about some of the J.J. Abrams kind of, you know, wit, you know, dialogue of humor in it. This had a lot of that. And obviously, some of it was sight gags, like Jar Jar stepping in poo, or, you know, the fart jokes. But
hilarious.
Hilarious. And that's where I've kind of like had that idea. Well, this movie really is not meant for a 28-year-old me. When I was watching this, it's more meant for the kids of the time. You know, this is a kids movie, and with adult themes, of course, with the politics and all. But the way it's the way it's done, it's, you know, it's for a kid. I had to remember that watching this time. And it's an okay movie, but after seeing the other 2 years later and seeing the whole prequel trilogy, it worked much better as a 3-pack than as just an individual movie. You know, obviously,
yeah,
we would think a little differently nowadays. Maybe as a standalone movie, it would still be good.
Yeah, that's kind of the catch, I think, with this, is that, you know, people weighed this against the original trilogy, and you know, it's part of the whole. It's not just that, you know.
Right.
I think that's where people got tripped up.
Yeah, I mean, once you see the 3 movies together, it's a good story. I mean, the Anakin Skywalker kind of progression is, you know, I feel like that's the whole basis for this prequel. And I think that's done very well. Eventually, you know, it had, like I said, it takes a few years and takes 3 movies, but it works, you know. I think my biggest complaint about the movie, other than, you know, who it was aimed at, which was not a complaint, it's just what it is the movie is not dynamic enough. The characters, you know, they desperately needed to be a Han Solo or a Lando in this movie.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of dry. I mean, I feel like the only scenes that kind of spiced it up was when, you know, Ian McDiarmid as the Palpatine or Samuel Jackson was on the screen. I'm like, wow, okay, this is kind of dramatic. You know, there was actually some seriousness to there. I think a movie that follows 2 Jedi Knights around is not going to be, you know, a fun fest.
Yeah. a little too somp. Yeah. You need like an Errol Flynn in there or something for some adventure. Right?
Like I said, you need somebody with a little pizzazz in there. You know, I mean, Jedi Knights by their nature are not going to, like, you know, other than using their lightsabers.
They're essentially monks, you know, right, and it's kind right. of warrior monks, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not fun.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
The fun Jedi is kind of a rare beast.
Right. Yeah. And to sum it up, I said it's a pretty movie as far as visuals and effects, and I think that saves it from the, you know, kind of wooden dialogue and just the low pulse the movie seems to have for me at sometimes.
Those are good observations, Mike. I think you kind of summarized the niche this movie falls into. It's if it's not the things you want it to be, is it really bad? Or you know,
yeah.
What are your expectations at some point, right?
And like Jar Jar Binks is really overshadows this movie when you're watching it now. And but the kids loved them, you know. And
of course, yeah.
You know, I got to look at it now as my 50 plus year old self and say, hey, you know, this is you know. Kids today would probably still like this movie, you know, if you watched it for the first time.
Yeah. What's that adage, you know, you judge things based on the audience they're created for, not, you know.
Right.
We're not going to go and critique. We're not going to go and critique ballet because we're not that niche, you know, but this was made for kids that like sci-fi and it hit, you know, so.
Yeah.
It kind of depends on the maturation level you have and what you come to expect, and context is really important.
And yeah, like
I don't know, I encourage
yeah like you said before, this movie was never going to meet expectations. It was I'm not gonna say doomed from
no chance
doomed from the start, but still it was not going to hit with everybody, and that, you know, no movie should be able to hit with everybody, you know.
I think that's called, the kids call that, haters gonna hate,
Mike. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a lot to unpack for this episode, guys. And, you know, we typically talk about some other things, but to be honest, me and Mike are kind of spent. I had to watch this movie 3 times, and Mike's been traveling. He compressed us in. So we're not going to talk about Star Wars anymore. We're done.
Hey.
But we do encourage everybody to go back and revisit these and do what we did and go outside your body and revisit them and see, then, you know, was that too harsh? Or did I like it too much?
It's not as bad as you think it is.
Yeah, time fixes a lot of wounds. So it may just, you know, it may remind you how much you hated it and, you know, put you in a bad spot. But hey, you know, not our fault. So that's going to wrap it up, guys. We want to thank everybody for listening as usual. If you're interested in following the show, you can reach us at Grumpy Nostalgia on Instagram. And if you feel compelled to contest or question some of our brilliant observations, you can send us an email at nostalgiagrumps@gmail.com. So it's been a pleasure. And Mike, I think we're going to wrap it up. Anything you want to add?
Excuse me? This is so wizard.
You take your brain so big. All right, Misa done. So for Mike, I'm Justin. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next time.